the meaning of the fall. Should be meanings, really, because where the topic was intentionally vague, because the fall can refer to the change of seasons, as in Southern California, the heat goes from unbearable to merely miserable, before turning to what is for us cold and the people in the Midwest laugh at us for. But yet there really are seasons aside from hurricanes and earthquakes. We do have seasons in Southern California, and we have seasons in our hearts. And the fall really relates to the cyclical nature of our lives. That in the fall, if you were to go back east or go a little bit to the north, you would see the trees change color, the leaves go from green to golden to red and finally to fall to the ground. And you have whole metaphors of life, of growth, of beauty at every stage, and also of death as the leaves fall, as the tree has hoarded its, and the leaves change because the tree is hoarding its sustenance to make it through the winter. And I suggest to you that we human beings do the same. We hoard the sustenance in order to make it through the winters and the midnights of our own souls and the winters of our discontents that come from time to time in every life. But those leaves are not done when they fall. They are also a source of life, a source of nutrition, that they mulch and become part of what sustains the tree again and creates and sustains new life. There is a wonderful ecology within ecology. There's a wonderful self-fulfilling pattern and cycle to the rhythms of nature, from which I think we can take inspiration. And for me, the seasons of the sun are also the seasons of the heart and of every life as we go from summer to fall to winter to spring, as many cycles as we can. The fall also refers in religion. It's the Christian term for the eviction notice that Adam and Eve got from the Garden of Eden. They broke the lease and the covenant. And the lease was really pretty easy. Just love one another, take care of each other, enjoy the garden, but whatever you do, don't eat the fruit. All right, so not every piece of religious order makes sense. To me, the fruit seemed like a good idea, a nutritional snack, but the CCNRs of the lease said, don't eat the fruit. They ate the fruit and then were, depending on your theology, were evicted from the garden. Seems pretty serious stuff reading fruit when you look at today's transgressions, but okay, those were different times. And in Christianity, the view of the fall is that this created a fundamental estrangement between human beings and divinity, an estrangement that needed to be made up. In Judaism, it is a rebuke that God is a little bit annoyed that the children have misbehaved, but it's not an eternal alienation. And in Islam, the Quran says that Adam and Eve realized that they had made a mistake and that they were sorry and that they were forgiven. So that the idea of a fundamental estrangement really is only within most orthodox views of Christianity. But it exists in other branches. The great question that the story raises, when you take it not literally but seriously, is the great biblical insight and Quranic insight that we're born kind of rebellious. We don't really follow the rules, even simple rules. And it raises the great question that was raised last week in the talkback about what is the nature of human nature. And why is it that we just can't, as Rodney King asked, why can't we just get along? And in some ways, that whole original sin, that whole rebellion idea is an insight into our human nature. The religious rules of most of our faiths are really pretty simple. When you get past all of the really complicated ways that you have to stand on one foot and sweep from east to west and how you sacrifice animals, the bottom line really is feed the hungry, clothe the naked, plead for the widow and orphan. Love each other. Walk humbly with your God. Take care of each other. Take care of the garden. It's not that hard, except it obviously is that hard. All of our religions tell us to love peace, to make peace. Blessed are the peacemakers. I don't know a passage that says blessed are the war makers. We understand, okay, somebody in the talkback is going to tell me the passage. We do understand that we use the terrible oxymoronic term holy wars. But I would remind you that while all of our religious scriptures recognize that people fight and recognize that some causes may seem better than others, it's always a tragedy. It's always a tragedy when we fight with each other, when we take each other's lives, substance, and dignity, when we fail to see the humanity in the other. The idea of original sin is not what so many people who have not actually read scriptures think it is. It's not about sex. Original sin is the originating sin of rebellion, the originating sin of getting evicted from the garden. And the interesting thing about it is that in Judaism, some branches of Christianity, and Islam, it's seen not as a terrible punishment, but as graduation. When you are in the Garden of Eden story, Adam and Eve are naked. Adam and Eve are immortal. Adam and Eve don't have to work for a living. In other words, they're like infants. They're not moral agents. They don't know the difference between good and evil. And when they finally eat of that tree, they get the insight of, uh-oh, I'm naked. And uh-oh, I got to get to work. And uh-oh, I am responsible for my actions. There are schools within the Catholic tradition that call the fall the blessed fall and understand it as a metaphor for growing up, not as a metaphor for being fundamentally estranged from God. I think that that's an important insight. I think it's an important insight that we become, by growing up, moral agents. And moral agents that get choices about how we are in the world. Sin, missing the target, quite literally, the word for sin in Hebrew is the same word as missing the target, and repentance, and I'm going to get to that next week, repentance is kind of taking aim again at your values, but we miss our targets. We miss our targets because we are human beings. And we are human beings who have impulses. And we have impulses that fight our impulses. And we have reason to fight our impulses. We tend sometimes to be very romantic about human nature. And, oh, look at the cute little baby. And I was celebrating the cute little baby yesterday. And the week before, I had cute little grandchildren for about 4 or 5 days, which is why I spent 2 days with a cold in bed, coughing and sneezing, because they really are beautiful, romantic, innocent little petri dishes. Very happy to share everything that they found with their friends, with their grandparents, and it takes us a while to build immunity. But children, if you want to know what original sin is, look at how we are. It is feed me, hold me, love me. Those are human instincts. And when we get older, it's feed me, hold me, love me. And when we get really old, it's feed me, hold me, love me. And the questions become, what do I do and what am I willing to do and what am I willing to take in order for somebody to see me, in order to pay attention to me, in order to feed me and hold me and love me. And incidentally, if you can't love me, then fear me, because I need to have some sense of power, some sense of an impact in the world. It's really hard to carve the pietà. And so the guy that took the axe to smash the pietà did it because he couldn't create it. And he got his identity in destruction. One of the things about human beings is that we get confused, and sometimes rightfully so, about creation and destruction. I think it was Aquinas who talked about original sin really not being just the Garden of Eden story, but our impulse to create chaos where there is order, our impulse to build up blocks and to knock them down, to build the houses of cards and enjoy that, and then blow them over and enjoy both the creative part and the destructive part. And I think that's true. I think that we have both of those impulses and that they are related. That creation and destruction are parts of cycles. That without the chaos and the spare parts, the building blocks, we have nothing to do. And then when we get something built, and we get something that's looking pretty good, it's watch the children playing with blocks. It's I'll build it this high and then boom. And the kids get joy of both parts of that process, the creation and the destruction. But most of us as adults only sing the praises of creation, and because we suppress the joy of destruction, as most things that are repressed and suppressed, we end up misusing it. We end up denying it. We end up not accepting it as part of the creative process. And those things that we would turn our backs on in shame or embarrassment or just not look at, those are the things that tend to haunt us. When I look at our world, I see creativity and I see destructiveness. I don't want to sing the praises of all of the destructive impulses, but I think that we have to own that part of the creative process. When I look at the world and I wonder, why is it that we need a social action committee? It should be perfectly obvious. You got a hungry person, you feed them. It should be perfectly obvious, as apparently it wasn't in the Republican debate, that if you have a 30-year-old person in a coma, you don't leave him on a street corner and just hope a church will pick him up. Now, that might have worked in the 19th century because we didn't have an awful lot of medicine. And whether a church or a hospital picked him up, he might have had a better chance with the church than with the hospital in the 19th century. But today, that's not possible. And so the question of values becomes, how do we manage our really good instincts to reach out to one another? How do we manage the really good instincts to care, to feed, to help, to try to see the humanity in each other? How do we celebrate and reinforce those things without denying the impulses that we may have to step back, to avert our eyes, to cover ourselves from seeing the poor and the homeless, so that maybe if we close our eyes, they won't be there. Maybe if we cross the street, they won't be there. Maybe if I can't see the humanity in that other person, I don't have to treat them like a human being. We've got all of these good impulses and all of these protective impulses, all of the urges to approach and connect in all of the urges to withdraw and protect ourselves. And they're all human and all of part of who we are. I see it all the time in the real world out there. Let's start with the faraway world in the Middle East. This is informed faith because I've studied it and I know lots of people. I could take 80 Palestinians and 80 Israelis at random and find the way to build peace. It's not a geographic problem. It's not a geometric problem. It's not an intellectual problem. The problem is that somewhere around 5% at either side of both populations, and I'm just using this exemplary, have a veto because of violence and because of an inability to say yes to peace. What is it that creates this inability to say yes to peace when the design is so clear? In American domestic politics, when you look at the disgusting performances of the Congress, both parties over the summer, I don't want to do complete moral equivalence, but the disgusting posing and posturing of both parties over the summer, did anybody not know that a budget was going to be passed in the last hour and a half? Did anybody not know that the debt ceiling was going to be raised and that people were going through a kabuki dance in order to gain political advantage, both sides, because the good of the American people was not central to the people at the political extremes? We don't live in the extremes. Almost everybody in this room lives within the broad and mostly reasonable and rational, sometimes middle. But the people at the extremes get the vetoes. The people at the extremes control the primaries. The people at the extremes control the center. We know what peace looks like. We know what political comity, not comedy, but comity looks like, treating each other with respect, listening to each other. We know how that works. But, you know, sometimes it's just more fun. You go to the fair and you pay a buck or two and you throw a plate or you throw a ball at a plate and you knock things down. Sometimes, whether in England or Seattle or Eugene, Oregon, you go and you have a riot. And the reason for the riot is, well, hell, it's fun to break windows. If destruction were not part of our impulse, those little booths wouldn't sell and half of the riots in the world wouldn't happen. We can't live in denial that there is something about the sound of shattering glass that at least guys like. I'm not going to put it on the other gender at this point, but you might want to testify in the talkback whether there's any particular. But even in the Greek restaurants, I've noticed that it's mostly the guys that are hurling the crockery. It's fun. We got to own that. We got to know it. We have to know something else when we wonder, why is it hard to make peace? Why is it hard to step back from a brink when you know you don't want to go over the brink? I imagine that everybody in this room has been in an argument with a loved one, whether a parent or a spouse or a partner or a child, and say, I don't want to say this. I don't want to say this. Oh, I just said it. And where you just are drawn to that cliff and you went, I don't want to do that. And then how do you walk it back? How do you get back from those moments? Why do we do it? And for once, this isn't a rhetorical question. I'm going to tell you why we do it. This is not a Tony Robbins positive reinforcement. What are these things called? Motivational speech. But everybody in this room is a winner. And that's a tragedy. Because it was our DNA that got out of the primordial soup. It was our DNA that got across the pampas in Africa. It was our DNA that survived to breed. It was our DNA that kept winning and winning and winning until it got us here. Hallelujah! Except that all of those wonderful traits that got us out of the soup and out of Africa and out of Europe and got us in here in beautiful Orange County on this beautiful day, are those necessarily the DNA traits, the evolutionary survival beneficial traits that will get us to the next century or to the next decade or to the next 2 weeks? And that's a very legitimate question. When we are looking at the order and the chaos, we have a nature. And the nature is sometimes violent, sometimes grasping, but where the story of the Garden of Eden gives us hope is that because we are moral agents, because we have in this room eaten of the tree of knowledge of the difference between good and evil, we can say no to some of those impulses. We can say no to some of the destruction. We can say no to some of the anger and some of the rage and get past those points of hurt. Last Sunday, those of you who were here will know that I did a sermon that was centered around the 10-year anniversary of commemorating 9/11. In the evening, I attended an interfaith service at Temple Judea in Encino that had combined choirs from Jewish, Catholic, Mormon, and Baptist churches, that had participation from ministers and priests and rabbis and imams and muezzins. And at one point, a Christian clergyman with a nice voice and a cantor with a nice voice and a Muslim muezzin with a nice voice all sang together. They all sang together, not kumbaya. They all sang together in their own, in English, in Hebrew, and in Arabic at the same time. They kept their integrity of their words and of their beliefs and of their faith traditions. And those voices and those languages coming together created not dissonance, but harmony. This was a teaching moment that was not cognitively teaching until an hour later. It was an emotional moment in real time because the harmony touched me, and I think touched every person in the room. This was a time when people could be going to their own corners and hurting all by themselves, or people could be coming together in truth and in dignity and in harmony. That's the great power of choice. That's the great power of being moral agents. That is what truly, when Pandora opened the box and all of those things flew out except hope, there was something else with hope, and it was choice. It was the choice not to listen when the bugles of rage call us forth to engage in destructiveness. It's the choice to step back from the precipice. It's the choice to open up our hearts and our arms to the idea, to the possibility of peace. As that service ended, I understood that it was a celebration of the hopeful. It was a celebration of the possible. It was a time when, instead of fear, there was hope that didn't wait for someone else to deliver it, but hope that came as a song from the voices of people who chose to mourn together, to celebrate together, to be together. The meaning of the fall is that we are moral agents with choices about how we are in the world. Despite impulses, There are choices. And we can, on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, not always and not perfectly, but have the power to choose life and to choose peace.